Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going after one of the biggest, most persistent assumptions of the modern era. The belief that globalization is this inevitable force for good, that it generates, you know, growing wealth and well-being for everyone.
Right. The old, a rising tide lifts all boats argument.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. We've been digging into the data on global risk, governance, and this relentless widening wealth gap.
And our mission today is really to move past the simple metrics.
Right. We want to distill the facts about wealth distribution, about inclusivity and sustainability.
Because the sources we looked at argue pretty forcefully, I think, that just looking at rising GDP, what we call economic growth, is not at all the same thing as true development.
That distinction is so crucial.
It is. Economic growth measured by GDP is, well, it's the ultimate blind metric.
It's just a number.
Just a number. It could be soaring,
yeah,
but it tells you absolutely nothing about how that new wealth is being distributed.
Or if that growth is even sustainable.
Or inclusive. I mean, if you really want to understand the world today, you have to look past that single top line number.
And when you do pull back that curtain on the GDP figure, this whole narrative of global convergence,
where the poor are catching up to the rich.
Yeah, that narrative, it starts to look a lot more like severe global divergence.
The imbalance is huge. If you look at the OECD countries versus what we call emerging market countries.
Yeah.
You're talking about 14% of the world's population in that developed OECD bloc.
Only 14%.
And a massive 86% in the emerging markets.
Wow.
So, I mean, it is overwhelmingly a world of developing nations.
But the economic power is just, it's dramatically flipped on its head.
Exactly. That small 14% of the population in the OECD countries, they still control 62% of global trade.
Wow.
And almost half, about 41% of total global GDP. So if the promise of globalization was that, you know, technology and trade would help everyone else catch up.
The data forces you to ask a tough question.
Yeah. Right. Is this system actually designed for global parity? Or is it maybe designed to perpetually benefit the countries that are already rich?
And our research shows that global inequality is, without a doubt, rising, especially within poor countries.
You can see it really clearly in the data showing the share of wealth captured by just the richest 1%. It just keeps climbing.
So globalization might be a rising tide, but if it's only lifting the super yachts, you have to say the system has failed the majority.
And that failure is felt so acutely at the very bottom. You know, even defining what extreme poverty is, that's an evolving challenge.
The World Bank just changed it, right?
They did. They shifted the threshold up from $1.90 a day to $3 a day.
Which sort of acknowledges that simply surviving isn't the same as actually escaping poverty.
That's it. But even with that new, slightly more generous threshold, we still have about 9% of the world population, that's close to 800 million people, stuck below that line.
And where are they? That's the critical part for this analysis.
Overwhelmingly concentrated. You find them in South Asia, and even more so in sub-Saharan Africa.
And that concentration, it just makes those populations so disproportionately sensitive to any global shock.
Absolutely. The data from the COVID pandemic is just, it's staggering.
Sobering is the word. The estimates suggest the crisis pushed an extra 150 million people into extreme poverty.
Just by 2023. And it was a double hit. It wasn't just the pandemic itself, but the combination of the health crisis and the stagflation that followed.
Which increased poverty almost everywhere.
In nearly every single country. When the global economic system shutters, the most vulnerable are always hit hardest and fastest.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting, because the progress has been so uneven.
Hmm.
If you track poverty reduction over the last decade or so, you see these two massive success stories, China and India.
An incredible achievement.
I mean, together they moved over 407 million people out of extreme poverty. That's one of the greatest achievements in human history, period.
It is. But the flip side of that coin is just tragic. In that same period, 26 countries in sub-Saharan Africa.
Places like Angola, the DRC, countries that are rich in resources.
Exactly. They actually saw the number of people living in extreme poverty go up.
So it's getting worse there.
It is. And the projection is bleak. By next year, 2025, two-thirds of the entire world's extreme poor will be living in sub-Saharan Africa.
That one statistic, that leads us right to one of the most paradoxical ideas in this whole deep dive.
The idea of rich countries with poor people.
Yes. How can a nation with immense natural wealth, oil, diamonds, you name it, still suffer from such rampant poverty?
Well, that's the defining problem of what we call the resource curse.
Or the resource trap.
Right, the resource trap. It's this paradox where a country that on paper, should be incredibly wealthy from its resources, actually underperforms socioeconomically.
So why does that happen? I mean, if you're sitting on a massive oil field, shouldn't that basically guarantee prosperity?
Theoretically, yes. But in practice, the wealth is often corrupted and concentrated at the top.
It doesn't trickle down.
Not at all. The causes are usually threefold. First, you get this unhealthy dependency on the price of just one thing, which makes your whole economy wildly unstable.
And second, a failure to diversify.
A total failure to build any other kind of economy. And the third, and maybe the most crucial, is just rampant government corruption.
You see this pattern in so many oil-producing nations.
Angola, Saudi Arabia, the list goes on. The money flows to the few, not the many.
So if GDP isn't development, what is? The research we looked at gives a pretty clear answer.
Development equals economic growth, plus the key conditions that make it sustainable.
And that's where governance comes in.
It's everything. Think about it like this. You have resource-rich nations like Gabon and Angola.
Yeah.
They might have a high GDP per person, right?
Yeah, the numbers look good.
But then you look at their human development index, how long people live, their education, their actual quality of life, and it is shockingly low.
They are rich on the national balance sheet, but the people are not developed.
Precisely. Now, contrast that with countries that have comparable or maybe even less GDP per capita,
yeah,
like a Chile or a Costa Rica.
Their life expectancy is much higher.
Much higher, and yeah, their human development index rankings are significantly better. The difference isn't the resources in the ground. It's the governance.
So the key takeaway is that poverty keeps getting worse in places like Africa because of bad governance and turmoil, no matter how much oil or gold they have.
Exactly.
And the moment you realize that bad governance and income distribution are the root cause, you have to turn that lens back on the developed world.
Mm-hmm.
Because at SAC-CT, income inequality is absolutely not a monopoly of developing countries.
No, not at all. Since the global financial crisis, the GNI index, which is our benchmark for inequality, has gotten worse for many wealthy nations. France, for instance. Many in the OECD.
And the data suggests this whole distortion in developed economies really kicked into high gear around the mid-1980s.
It did. And that timing coincides with the massive worldwide expansion of the market economy.
So what happened?
Well, you started to see a rising share of profits in GDP and at the same time a falling share of wages.
This is what economists call the scissor effect.
The scissor effect, yeah. Labor productivity keeps going up. Workers are creating more value, but the average wage just stalls. It creates this huge growing gap.
There was that McKinsey research,
which really hammered this home. It found that 2/3 of households in 25 advanced economies saw their real wages and income either flatline or actually fall between 2005 and 2015.
2/3 of households. How many people is that?
That's 550 million people whose economic lives basically stalled.
And the timing here is just so key. The rise of what our sources call hyperfinance in the 1980s, it maps perfectly onto this explosion in inequality.
It does. And hyperfinance, I mean, it basically represents the deregulation and massive expansion of financial markets.
And that shifted power, right, and rewards away from productive wages.
And towards capital ownership and top executive compensation. It's a systemic change.
And it's why inequality, which had actually declined for decades after the war, just came roaring back.
You can see it so clearly in the U.S. data. Just a massive accumulation of wealth at the very, very top, and a shrinking middle class since the late 1940s. Deregulation has consequences.
It's still happening. I mean, look at the euro area. Net wealth shot up 27% in 5 years.
Yeah. And while rising home prices did help some middle class homeowners, the concentration is still stunning. The top 10% held 56% of the wealth.
And the bottom half?
The entire bottom half of the population. They collectively held just 5%. The system is just designed to favor capital concentration.
So we've identified the problem. It's systemic, it's rising, it's driven by a system that favors capital and suffers from governance failures.
Now for the hard part.
The solutions.
No.
And what the debate sources make really clear is that there is no simple silver bullet solution here.
No, but you can sort of distill the arguments down into three powerful schools of thought.
Okay, let's lay them out.
So first, you have the school of thought championed by people like Joseph Stiglitz. They believe capitalism is fundamentally broken, and it needs urgent intervention.
So what's their prescription?
Strong government action. Fiscal stimulus to boost demand, big minimum wage increases, and tax incentives for businesses that invest in labor, not just capital.
Okay, so that's school number one. What's number two?
Number two is the more traditional liberal school. Their argument is essentially patience.
Patience, trickle-down economics.
Right. They believe that things like better education, continuous retraining, human capital investment, that will eventually allow the benefits to correct the imbalance over time.
And the third.
The third is Thomas Piketty. He argues that the golden age of shared growth is over. It's finished.
And his solution is pretty radical.
It is. He proposes a global wealth tax, arguing we're returning to a state of patrimonial capitalism where inherited wealth is king.
So Piketty's argument, it really rests on this simple but kind of terrifying mathematical inequality. R is greater than G. Mm-hmm. So what does this all mean for you listening at home?
It means that the rate of return on capital, R, that's what you get from assets, stocks, real estate, is systematically greater than the rate of economic growth, G.
And G is what drives most people's wage increases.
Exactly. So when R is always higher than G, the rich get richer faster than the productive economy can even expand.
Inequality becomes self-perpetuating.
Right. Their money makes money faster than your labor does.
It's a really elegant, compelling theory, but it's not settled science. The critics have strong counterarguments.
Oh, absolutely. Critics from places like the Brookings Institution and the IMF, they argue that the actual rate of return on capital may not be as high or as consistent as Piketty assumes.
And they also point to other factors.
Right. They say that rising inequality isn't just a simple formula. It's linked to these broader sociopolitical factors, like falling union membership, weakened labor bargaining power, and the de-skilling of jobs. It's more complex.
So this whole deep dive really forces us to conclude that measuring socioeconomic success, it requires looking so far beyond a simplistic number like GDP.
You have to.
We have to focus relentlessly on income distribution, on wealth gaps, and on inclusive growth if we want anything like an accurate picture of global stability.
And the final framework, I think, is pretty clear. Development, at the end of the day, equates to social inclusiveness.
And achieving that isn't just about the right economic policy.
No, it requires the right political choices. Sustainable growth needs social mobilization. It needs stability within what we should really call a nation.
You mean a cohesive group with a shared identity and trust.
Exactly. Not just a country, which is really just a line drawn on a map.
You can almost visualize it as a triangle, this socio-political stability triangle.
That's a great way to put it. You need institutional strengthening on one corner, dynamic economic growth on another, and sustainable inclusive development on the third. They all have to support each other.
And the lesson is that dynamic growth, when you combine it with bad governance and corruption, will always just collapse into that wealth gap and destroy social inclusiveness.
Country risk is fundamentally tied to income distribution. It's tied to the wealth gap. When institutions fail to ensure fairness, stability is the first casualty.
So our discussion today shows this really clear link between governance and development success, especially when you're trying to break free from that toxic resource curse.
Mm-hmm.
Given that stability requires institutional strength, not just economic policy, that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to mull over. What specific non-economic institutional changes, I'm talking about things like judicial reform or real anti-corruption laws, do you believe are most critical to breaking the resource curse in countries that are struggling with endemic corruption? We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.